Today at Reader's Corner, Parag Khanna, author of How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance.
The new colonialism is an example of mega-diplomacy that has generally positive goals. The trouble is that it sometimes creates very strong dependency problem, and that's the pitfall of the new colonialism. American diplomacy is any time an American tourist goes abroad. It's any time an American company invests abroad. It's any time an American university opens a campus abroad. We are the most globally engaged society in the world, so we ought to know a bit more about the places where we're either doing business or fighting wars, that's for sure.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The world's power structure is shifting. In How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance, Parag Khanna explores complex questions about how we can deal with a changing global landscape in a more effective way. According to Dr. Khanna, 21st century diplomacy is beginning to resemble the Middle Ages, a period when no single power was in control, but where cities, companies, mercenaries, churches, and other entities exerted overlapping authority. Similarly, today's organizations are confronted with global issues that extend beyond the abilities or authority of governments to address. In How to Run the World, Dr. Khanna makes the case that a new kind of diplomacy is needed in this fragmented world, and that technology and money, rather than sovereignty, will determine who has the authority. Dr. Khanna is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He earned a Ph.D. from the London School of Economics and undergraduate and graduate degrees from the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His other books include the national and international bestseller, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Dr. Khanna joins us today via Skype from London, where he is a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics Ideas Center. Parag Khanna, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, back when I studied international relations, it was largely a study of the test of wills and power among nation states. The principal actors were indeed the nation states of the world. You seem to be describing a global landscape in which you travel, in which you research and study as something very different today. Help us understand that.
Well, it certainly still is a contest of wills and power. As we all know, we see a rising China, we see the Iranian nuclear issue. Power still matters a great deal, but it isn't just states anymore. You know, states coexist now with companies, with NGOs, with super empowered individuals, with terrorist groups, with philanthropists, all sorts of players that are shaping the global agenda, that are getting things done, that are really creating a lot of, that really have a lot of influence. And of course, international organizations as well, such as the International Monetary Fund or the World Trade Organization or the World Bank. So this is a much more complex world than those 20th century, largely theoretical models that we really grew up thinking corresponded to reality, and they don't really anymore. And as you said, I've written about how we kind of have to go back about 1,000 years to see a world in which East and West were both powerful at the same time, when China, in fact, was the most advanced civilization in the world. And, Western civilization was in the Dark Ages. The Middle East, the Arab caliphates and empires were very powerful. India was powerful, too. So in a way, some of the things that we take for granted today, a multipolar world where Asia is rising, well, we've had that before. It was 1,000 years ago. And the other interesting thing is that that was a time when it wasn't just about countries and nations. In fact, they didn't really exist. We had these overlapping kinds of authorities. There were cities, there were empires, churches. Think of the Holy Roman Empire, of course, or again, the Islamic dynasties. You had mercenaries, you had universities, you had all of these different kinds of players that were really shaping the world. And again, I think that's the case today.
Well, the one kind of player that probably wasn't shaping the world the way it is today is the NGO, which, of course, stands for non-governmental organization, for our listeners who may not be familiar with that term. Help us understand the NGO of the 21st century. Who are we talking about here? The Gates Foundation comes to mind, and you mention it in your book, but give us a few other examples of organizations that really have become primary players in global politics.
Sure. Well, let's start with one that isn't so new, and it's the Catholic Church. I mean, religious groups are non-governmental organizations, and the Catholic Church and many other religious entities are, of course, extraordinarily powerful and influential. They're wealthy. They have ambassadors. They have missionaries. They are able to shape national politics. You know, when the Pope John Paul II is sometimes credited with having a role in influencing ideology of the Soviet Union or at least Eastern Europe, particularly in his home nation of Poland. The current pope has just gone to Cuba and other countries. So that's just one example. But yes, the Gates Foundation, our universities are non-governmental organizations as well, whether it's Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge. They also are very influential players in the world because of their science and their research and the agendas that they can push through their knowledge. And then there's, of course, Amnesty International, Greenpeace, so many of these non-governmental organizations that are international, global, like Oxfam, that have a lot of money and they spend it however they want to. They don't get bossed around anymore. No one tells the Gates Foundation what to do. In fact, you find them shaping the national politics and certainly the health policy of many countries. And health is not just a major debate in America, like healthcare, Obamacare. Health is a big issue, a matter of life and death, just about everywhere in the world. So the Gates Foundation is a really significant player. But what I want to add is that NGOs aren't just the big international players headquartered in Paris or London or New York. It's also local civil society. You know, the Arab Spring was really carried out by groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, which is another non-governmental organization, or student unions, or the student groups that were brought together by Twitter and Facebook and other technologies. Those are all non-governmental organizations as well. Labor unions that are incredibly powerful in other societies, you know, that represent the working class and underclass and so forth, they also are non-governmental organizations. So really, the diversity of these kinds of players goes on and on.
Well, this certainly requires enormous adjustment when it comes to diplomacy skills. And you mentioned the Catholic Church. Vatican diplomacy was once considered, if it isn't still, the best practice. The finest diplomats of the world would be sent out from the Vatican. At least I remember that somewhere in my old international relations courses. How well are diplomats, whether they're in the Vatican or whether they're in the State Department, doing today in keeping up with this incredibly different landscape that you've just described?
Well, on average, the answer would have to be not very well. You know, small and agile countries that have the ability to partner quickly with their key companies to help to promote their national image and influence and commercial linkages abroad, they're adapting well because they don't have to cope with massive diversity and huge internal political squabbles, the kinds of things that we have to here in America. So, you know, the answer is, to some extent, it depends. But on the other hand, I can clearly see, as I spend a lot of time in embassies and foreign ministries and our own State Department, that we're really only starting to get a grip on this. I want to give some credit to the current administration, which I think has started to kind of wake up to this and organized a lot of meetings in Washington where they say, we don't have the money or the knowledge about the entire world to sort of just shape everything on our own. Instead, let's bring together all the, you know, academic leaders in America, all the diaspora groups, all the sports groups, all the sister city programs to Washington one by one in different conferences, and let's see what are the things that these communities can export from America. What are the things that they are achieving here that we can teach abroad? And so rather than trying to either raise taxes or raise the budget, although I do think the State Department deserves more money, but it's just not getting it. But rather than say, let's just throw more money or more bodies at the problem, they're saying, let's just be smarter and let's harness the diversity of American society. And I think that's a good example of saying American diplomacy is not just what Hillary Clinton says. It's not just what Washington does. American diplomacy is any time an American tourist goes abroad. It's any time an American company invests abroad. It's any time an American university opens a campus abroad, such as in the Middle East. There are 40 American universities that have campuses in the Middle East. There's no better way imaginable to promote human rights and women's rights and liberal thinking in the Middle East than to open American universities there. That's diplomacy. So I think of all of these things as examples, best practices in diplomacy, and they don't originate from Washington. They're done by ordinary citizens.
I know it's impossible for an author to summarize an entire book in the answer to one question, but your previous work, The Second World, How Emerging Powers Are Redefining Global Competition in the 21st Century, does call our attention not so much to the third world, which we're all familiar with, at least in terms of reading and listening to the international reports coming in from around the world. But the second world that is emerging and the extent to which we as a country, I'm talking now mainly about American foreign policy, begin to understand it. And it seems as though in Latin America in particular, that's where we've really stumbled for a good number of years. Now, you mentioned the new administration. I think that the Obama administration has made some efforts there. But help us understand what's different about dealing with the second world as opposed to the way we traditionally dealt with the third world or with our first world allies or enemies, for that matter.
Well, the second world really encompasses, to my mind, not, you know, 40 or 50 countries that are really important, pivotal, regional anchor states and influential countries in their regions that we so often either ignore or we caricature. We have very kind of dated information and stereotypes about them, or we don't even realize where they are in the map and how significant they are. And I'll give you a whole bunch of examples that I've written in that book, a chapter each on each of the following countries that are so strategically important and we know so little about them. And they include places like Venezuela and Colombia, places like Libya and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Syria, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, Indonesia and Malaysia. So those are a few examples of countries that I feature in that book. And you see half of them have popped up in the news quite a lot in just the last year or two. And we more or less ignored them prior to that. And I think that was a big mistake because we're seeing just how strategic and important they are and how they can grab not only our headlines but affect our entire foreign policy. So we need to be paying attention to these second world countries a lot more than we do, which is why I spent a good number of years just traveling through as many of them as I could.
As you rattle off these NGO actors that play such a pivotal role across the globe, I have to wonder what's going on in the Department of State to keep track of this kind of mega diplomacy, or you use the word mega diplomacy. Maybe you can help us understand what mega diplomacy means in the 21st century and how it applies when it comes to this second world and our relationship to it as far as the United States is concerned.
Absolutely. You know, let's just jump straight to the contemporary example of Egypt, where we can issue statements and lecture them about what their constitution needs to look like or what they should or should not have done with President Hosni Mubarak. And that's all state-to-state level stuff. Mega diplomacy is about bringing in the non-state actors, the companies, and so forth. The fact is this: if you want to help Egypt today, if you want Egypt to be stable, if you want Egypt to be peaceful, if you want Egypt to be democratic, you need to do in the following order. You need to invest money in that country. We need foreign investment. Now, our government gives aid to that country's government. We don't invest in its people. We don't create jobs for them. We don't integrate them into supply chains. Those are things that companies do. Mega diplomacy is about Western governments, the G8, the G20, the European countries, us, partnering with companies and convincing them, providing insurance for them to go into those countries and create jobs. If you're not doing that, you're not really helping them. They've spent decades telling us how we've been supporting the wrong government. They've spent decades telling us what's wrong with their constitution and how we should be supporting constitutional change. They don't need us to lecture them about that. They don't need traditional diplomacy. They need mega diplomacy in which our NGOs go in and help them and support civil society and build new universities. They need companies such as ours to go in there and create jobs in manufacturing and technology and other areas. So mega diplomacy would be where we, whether it's in Washington or elsewhere, say, what can we do as companies, as the government, as civil society to help all Egyptians, not just the government? And that is exactly why mega diplomacy matters so much today, because speeches just don't matter anymore.
And I assume you don't think the role of the military matters quite as much in this case.
Well, that's another one of those, you know, it depends. I mean, having worked myself for the Department of Defense and served in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, I've seen very well what the military can and cannot do. The military is still extremely important. You know, our military is a major deterrent against conflict in parts of the world, such as the Middle East right now, or in the Far East with respect to China and other countries. So that's a role that the military is playing, even when we're not fighting per se. And then there are places where we are, of course, fighting. Now, what we have learned, though, is that the military can sort of win battles but not wars, because the political objectives of Iraq and Afghanistan have certainly not been met despite the overwhelming amount of military resources and money that we've committed to both those situations. So it's not to say that it doesn't matter. It matters a lot. The question is, does it work? And the answer is, the military alone, just like diplomacy alone, is never going to get you across the finish line.
You're listening to Parag Khanna. He is the author of How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. He has also written The Second World, How Emerging Powers Are Redefining Global Competition in the 21st Century. You talk about the new colonialism in How to Run the World, Parag, and I found that a very interesting aspect of international relations that I guess I just hadn't picked up on. The great advantages that NGOs can bring to countries like Africa, but in some ways you suggest that it may hold back countries from dealing and solving their own problems. I'm paraphrasing greatly here, but I'll let you explain that to us.
The new colonialism is an example of mega diplomacy, right? The old colonialism was the British East India Company or the British government, and obviously the French and Spanish and Portuguese as well, conquering overseas and creating overseas dominions, which they ruled from afar and through colonial administration. The new colonialism is obviously something different because it has generally positive goals, such as the NGOs and the U.S. military and NATO and other players who are active in Afghanistan, for example. The trouble is that it sometimes creates a very strong dependency problem where locals don't want to work for their own government. They'd rather work for American NGOs that pay better, right, to serve as translators or drivers or even cooks. And so it kind of hollows out the ability of a local society to eventually self-govern. Kosovo today has been a lot like that. So many people in Kosovo or Kosovars work for the European governments and for NATO or the European Union. They need to be working for Kosovo. Afghans need to be working for Afghanistan, right? Not for just Oxfam or for Western companies or for NATO or for the UN. That creates this sort of perverse situation that we face today of long-term dependency. And that's the pitfall of the new colonialism. On the other hand, of course, we inject resources into a country that it desperately needs. So you can't sort of get by without the new colonialism, but the new colonialism runs the risk of overstaying its welcome.
If you could describe for us in Africa how we might deal with what I think you call the redefinition of boundaries in Africa. It does get difficult to keep track of new emerging countries, and you seem to be suggesting that oftentimes these boundaries do not make as much sense when it comes to the sovereignty of the people.
That's exactly right. Well, I mean, Africa today, Africa is one of the largest continents in the world and has the largest number of countries of any continent, 53 countries in Africa. And many of the boundaries date to the 1885 Congress of Berlin. So before the end of colonialism, a colonial settlement between European powers that demarcated these boundaries with very little respect to ethnographic issues in Africa. So you see people divided who should have belonged together and so forth. And so a lot of the sort of disturbances and disruptions and civil wars and that have ensued are partially the result of these false colonial boundaries. Now, that's why I advocate redrawing the map of Africa. Now, this is happening anyway. The birth of South Sudan, as an example, just 1 year ago, almost to the day, where South Sudan split. Now, South Sudan is a sub-Saharan African Christian population that has been dominated by the northern Arab population. Sudan is one of the second largest country in Africa and was this sort of really inappropriate hodgepodge of ethnic groups, and now it's been split into two. We'll see other places split in that way. Congo, the largest country in all of Africa, is so weak that it doesn't really even exist per se. The sub-regions of Congo are really under the influence of their neighbors, such as Rwanda, which is much smaller, ironically, than even of its own central government. So there's a slow and painful process going on of redefining Africa's boundaries, and I believe that a lot more effort should be made to preemptively do it. Now, that sounds like a recipe for a lot of war, but we have a lot of wars even if we don't try and convene these parties diplomatically to redraw their boundaries. So I think this is actually something that we should focus a lot more attention on, because if we were to do that, we might be actually unlocking the potential for countries to cooperate more with each other, and then they would be less dependent on outsiders. So I think that there is a win-win formula here if we were to focus more on Africa, which we don't. And as you mentioned, you know, we haven't focused much on Latin America either, even though it's our own backyard.
As we do focus on Africa and Latin America and South America, how does the United States use democracy as the metric as to whether or not we support or don't support? And does the United States have to develop a set of metrics that are larger and more expansive than whether or not a country meets the same democratic standards that we like to think apply to us?
Well, I think we've been learning, you know, now, especially in a multipolar world where China is out there making connections and alliances everywhere, it's very hard to isolate countries simply because they're not democratic. You know, we're having a very hard time isolating Iran or Syria, in the Iranian case, for literally decades, because there's many other powers that will do business with them and will support them. In fact, if you look at Africa, every single country that we try to isolate and call a rogue state, whether it's Zimbabwe or Sudan or other places, these are all countries that China actually provides economic assistance to and buys resources from, and others do as well. It's not really just a two-party Cold War-like situation. So we have to actually be a lot more flexible in who we deal with and how we deal with them, and realize that we're not the only game in town. So that's, I think, the first answer to the question. And do we need to think beyond democracy? Yes. There are a lot of other metrics we can look at besides just, you know, have they held elections and is the government democratically elected? There are many democratically elected governments that are horrendously corrupt and exploitative. So we need to be looking at is how are they managing investments in the country? Is there a growing rate of literacy? Is there investment in infrastructure? Can we help bring about these things? And if we do, we'll see that governance will improve gradually. But you don't really improve governance by giving everyone the cold shoulder.
You mentioned China again. I'd like to talk about this new colonialism issue, not so much from the NGO standpoint, but from China's relationship with Africa. We've all read over the years the positive and negative impact of British, French, and Belgian colonialism in Africa, and the way they extracted natural resources, took them back home, and oftentimes inserted themselves into the internal politics of countries. And then when independence was declared, things were really up in the air. Now it's China that seems to be the new colonial empire moving into Africa, doing it much differently, I'm sure, and you would know that, and that's why I'm asking the question. How do you distinguish between what China is doing, and I'm not suggesting China's doing it right, because I've heard and read too many cases of abuses, but if you could give us an example of where China is today in using Africa as their natural resource compared to British, French, and Belgian colonialism.
Well, and this is why I think there is a big distinction between new and old colonialism. And now we're not talking about NGOs anymore, but just looking at 17th and 18th and 19th century European practices in Africa versus what China is doing today. China has been very welcome in Africa because it's investing in building infrastructure. Now, it's committed a lot of small mistakes by bringing in lots of local labor, not hiring enough Africans, and building infrastructure largely just to extract minerals and not so much, you know, to help locals. But that's also changing. It's built lots of roads and parliament buildings and sports stadiums and health clinics. It's doing a lot of those things. And that's the equivalent of saying money talks. Because we can denounce what China is doing in Africa and say, oh, they're supporting rogue regimes and things like this. But believe it or not, the people are benefiting from the growth rates that come from having minerals efficiently extracted and sold on the global market. What we have done as Western countries in the last 60 years in terms of sending in politically motivated aid, also going to autocratic regimes, not necessarily supporting the people, and often just recycling that money back into Western companies and consultants, that really hasn't helped the people much. Because if you travel around Africa, you won't see a whole lot of new infrastructure since basically the last half century, since the end of European colonialism. So all of our aid money, there are many countries where you wonder where it all went and what it all did. So China has come along at precisely the right time when the infrastructure is collapsing, the people need roads and railways, they need to exploit their resources and sell them on the market to make enough money to feed their people because their populations have grown double or triple or sometimes four times the population size that they had just a half century ago. So China's timing is actually really good from their standpoint and from Africa's standpoint. And just remember this, this is the big difference. You know, we do live in an age of sovereignty to the extent that African countries can say no. They can say, thanks to the roads, now walk the plank. Thanks to the railways, but get out of here. Or, you know, you're not paying enough taxes, now pay more. And I think that that's something that's really important to remember. What's happening today is not Belgian troops marching in, with bayonets. This is very different. This is actually partnerships, and that's actually what China calls it. And they're basically right about that.
You mentioned in your book that there will be times when heads of states have to be removed, including through the use of assassination to solve international problems. Could you comment on what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think that we should use, as we have in the past, and do sometimes without saying so, targeted political assassinations in cases where an individual has been indicted by the International Criminal Court or represents the sole singular obstacle to the liberation of a society and to its fulfilling its natural development, in cases where people have been suppressed and are dying en masse. These are very good justifications for assassinating one person if that one person is genuinely that which is getting in the way. You can debate and deliberate in the UN Security Council for months and then just arrive at the natural conclusion, but you really could have acted a lot sooner and a lot more sensibly. And that's obviously not the only case where assassinations would be justified, are justified, and should be used. Now, bear in mind, we don't have to be the only ones doing it. This is not about whether or not America should go around assassinating people. The first thing is to demonstrate efficiently that these individuals deserve to be killed, captured, or apprehended. And that can be an international process, but it needs to go a lot faster. And then it doesn't matter so much whether we do it or whether the French do it or whether the UN does it, but it does need to be done, and we need to be clear about that.
You know, if one doesn't have a chance to read How to Run the World, I'm not so sure we get a very good take from around the world on what's going on what you've been talking about here in this interview. I just wonder what your take is on American media's efforts in educating the citizens in terms of what is going on around the world. I really have to question whether or not citizens get nearly the information they need to make intelligent decisions at the polling place.
Well, let's face it. I mean, you know, the average American citizen, or indeed most all American citizens, are not really involved in our foreign policy decision-making at all. Foreign policy, not just in America, but anywhere else in the world, has literally always been an elite sort of practice, you know, something that isn't done particularly democratically per se. Most of us vote on the basis of economic issues, not really on the basis of foreign policy issues at all. So I think that, you know, there's a limit to what we can expect in terms of how engaged the average citizen is going to be. I think that applies particularly to America. I mean, we're having this conversation about the world, and it would be nice to expect that everyone should be adequately informed about everything that's happening in the world. But we do all have our day-to-day concerns. And we in America in particular have the luxury of being separated by two big oceans from much of the rest of the world. So I think, you know, the expectation that Americans in particular need to, as a whole, you know, speak all these foreign languages and understand everything that's happening elsewhere, it's probably a bit too much to ask. On the other hand, we are the most globally engaged society in the world, so we ought to know a bit more about the places where we're either doing business or fighting wars, that's for sure.
Well, Parag, we've run out of time, but I really want to thank you for joining us today all the way from London, and thank you in particular for writing How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. Again, the author, Parag Khanna, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Next week, Washington Post foreign correspondent Pamela Constable, author of Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Matt Penny. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.